From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As the annual United Nations Climate Conference in Madrid, Spain ended, climate justice activists denounced the conclusion of the two-week-long meeting as weak, in what has now become a dreaded, predictable outcome of the COP or Conference of Parties meetings. Country representatives walked away without making significant concessions on curbing their fossil fuel emissions or paying for adaptation. We go now to Madrid to speak with Colin Reese, senior campaigner with Oil Change US. Welcome to the program, Colin.
Thanks so much for having me, Sonali.
So the meeting was supposed to end, I believe, Friday, went an extra 2 days, which is sort of normal. Do you fear, and I'm not sure if this is your first time attending these or you've been before, but is there sort of a sickening predictability with these meetings being prolonged and then not actually ending up with anything of significance, with the exception of the Paris Accord 4 years ago?
I think there are exceptions, but that's more or less the trend. I think this was actually the longest extension in the history of the process. This was the 25th climate talks, and it broke the record for previous longest extension by about 8 hours. And I think it sadly has become more common in recent years. I do think there's actually an important equity piece and kind of a tactical piece to extending the negotiations like this. Before the final plenary happened on Sunday, they actually had to do a quorum, a roll count of the room to make sure they had enough countries to even move forward legally to make decisions. Because what happens is the poorer countries, the global south countries, the countries who are less well off, can't afford to change their flights, can't afford to extend their hotels. And so you end up with, as many of these other processes, essentially compiling effects that mean that the rich countries, the countries who are able to bring more delegates, et cetera, are the ones who are there at the end. Everybody is exhausted, of course, but just structurally, it leads to kind of poor decisions in a way, I think, and it's really not that great to see.
So remind us what the goal of the COP25 was and how close they got to meeting that goal.
Great question. I think there are a couple different outcomes that people were hoping for from COP25, myself included. And I have been, this is my seventh COP now, so I am somewhat of a veteran of this process, for better or for worse. From COP25, I think people wanted two things. One was a strong signal of clear ambition, a clear signal that countries were planning to increase their targets ahead of this next cycle. Next year, the COP26 in Glasgow is going to be in a very important check-in from the Paris Agreement to see how are we doing 5 years out from when the Paris Agreement was signed. How can we start to bend this curve back towards what it looks like to get to 2 degrees or to 1.5 degrees, essentially for countries to increase their ambition significantly so that we're actually on track to be doing these things. So ambition was one piece. And the second piece that people expected were to deal with two fairly technical issues that were left over from the previous COP. One was something called Article 6, which is essentially setting in place the rules that will govern potential carbon markets that could be used to help reduce emissions across the board and to meet Paris goals. So carbon markets was one piece. And then the second piece was loss and damage. Loss and damage refers to the damages and the losses that have been suffered by countries impacted by climate change, particularly in the global south, for which there can be no adaptation. We talk about adaptation as in ways that you can adapt to climate change, architectural changes, infrastructure changes, perhaps paying for seawalls, things like that. There are many, many, many iterations of adaptation, but loss and damage actually says, no, there's actually a category that goes beyond adaptation. There are some things that you can adapt to, such as when your entire nation is sinking into the sea. And so that's something for which there needs to be additional consideration, additional compensation, et cetera.
Right. And so, when you have such things with rising sea levels, it's not just about financial compensation. There's also things like migration and, you know, the movement of people and how countries continue to sort of police their borders selfishly. So did some of the developing nations that are also very big nations like India, Brazil, China. Those nations have played a unique role in these COP meetings in general, because these are countries that are trying to industrialize and yet have not been the biggest traditionally and historically the biggest contributors to emissions, although China is sort of on the cusp of changing that. What role did those big economies from the developing world play?
I think you're exactly right that this is sort of a special category of countries, the BRICS, as it were, mm-hmm. that is rapidly industrializing, but historically has not been responsible for as many emissions. I think what you saw was somewhat predictable, which is a different, slightly different response from each of these countries. India and China continued to hold this position as saying, we are happy to do some things, we need to do some things, but we need assistance to do it. This is not historically been our problem. We are willing to take some steps, but we have to, with that, see greatly increased ambition from the global north, from the countries who have the capacity to do this, and also greatly increased aid, greatly increased finance to help the global south adapt in these different ways. And I think I'll say that Brazil was uniquely unhelpful this year. They actually were one of the absolute worst actors in the climate talks, which will probably not surprise anybody who knows anything about Jair Bolsonaro, the new far right-wing, even fascist president of Brazil, who has done things like said, burning the Amazon is actually our contribution to climate change. We're helping and just really is killing indigenous human rights defenders on a daily basis. During the COP itself, helped push through a law essentially legalizing criminal land grabs that have happened over the last decades. Brazil, both inside the process at the climate talks and then back home with what they were doing, was uniquely positioned as a terrible actor here. And I think the question is, what are the enforcement mechanisms? What is the response to that going to be? Will they get away with it, or will countries actually do something about it?
And then what about the U.S., which has the largest per capita contribution to the climate crisis and also headed by a fascistic right-wing dictator who has thumbed his nose at the issue of climate change? Were there any U.S. representatives present in an official capacity? And if so, what role did they play?
There were some U.S. representatives present at the climate talks over the last couple of weeks. And I think they actually, this is going to sound bad, because obviously we know that the Trump administration is, as you mentioned, fascistic, really extremely right wing and terrible. But we actually didn't expect them to be quite as bad as they ended up being. The U.S. delegation,
I think,
they
were worse than you expected them to be. Oh, boy.
That is what I mean. And I think I perhaps set my expectations wrong. But I think they sort of fooled the media and NGOs and essentially said, we are pulling out of this agreement. It's not something that we're going to be in the future. And so we're going to be there. We're going to play a technical role. Essentially, we need to be there, but we're not going to be getting involved in political issues. We're going to be in the room to provide expertise in some measures, some technical pieces, but we're not going to try to be a major part of it. And then what we saw was perhaps what would be more predictable, which was that they were constantly meddling in everything, including the things in which they will have no say in after this next year. They were absolutely wrecking the loss and damage negotiations in many ways, ended up with a far worse result because of that. They were trying to take some things that are currently only in the Paris Agreement and actually pull them back into the UNFCCC, which is there's several levels of negotiations going on. And so the U.S. has pulled out of the Paris Agreement and will no longer be a party to that, but it will actually still be a part of the UN climate process. And so they were trying to take some of these critical issues and say, actually, we think this should be dealt with in the entire UN climate process, not just the Paris Agreement, which is essentially saying we want to continue to meddle in this even as we pull out of the Paris Agreement. So I think we really did see uniquely strong and bad pressure, slightly more than we expected, perhaps, and the U.S. was one of the absolute worst actors of the talks.
What about the European Union? I understand that one of the big announcements that came out of it was the EU agreeing to be climate neutral in several decades, but Poland still continued to sort of cling to fossil fuels. Germany was the target. Its coal mines were the target of activists while country representatives were at the COP25. What did the EU agree to? Was it more lip service than actual action?
I think some of that remains to be seen. The EU, in many ways, was able to hide behind Australia, behind the US, behind Japan in some ways, behind these countries that were taking more bold, aggressively bad stances. But it was not out front leading and saying, no, that's a bad idea. This is a dynamic that we've seen over many years, is that the global North countries sort of rotate the target around themselves. And they say, this year, this country is going to be the bad guys, and everybody else can kind of be quiet and stay behind so that they don't get as much public pressure, but that they don't have to commit to actual things. And so I think the US or the EU has continued to play that role in many ways. I think what we saw with the net zero by 2050 announcement that you mentioned for essentially everybody but Poland was, I would say, not the ambition that we need to see. It was a next step, but we're going to need to see significantly stronger ambition from the EU if we're going to have a chance at confronting the climate crisis. We know that the entire world needs to be at net zero by 2050 at the absolute latest to have a chance at 1.5. So the fact that Europe, possibly the place with the most capacity to shift, is only saying that is their own deadline is really problematic. And we need massive amounts of finance and aid and technology transfer. Essentially, we need the EU to step up in a lot of ways to help the global south be able to adapt. And we also need the EU to get very serious about a just transition to phase out their fossil fuel production. I think that's something that we saw really discussed for one of the first times on the global stage this year, was an increasing discussion around countries' fossil fuel production and how that doesn't align with a lot of the emissions targets that they're setting.
Right. On the one hand, they may agree to or talk about reducing fossil fuel emissions somewhere in the future, at the same time as they're building new infrastructure that will ensure the continued dominance of fossil fuel energies. Now, would you say that the words of Greta Thunberg, the famed Swedish teen activist at the COP25, around her accusation that countries were engaged in creative PR is accurate? She basically said, you're talking up a good talk, but if you scratch below the surface, you're literally, you know, you're actually doing nothing.
I think there's a tremendous amount of truth to Greta's words, as you mentioned at the talks. She came and spoke also, of course, to the hundreds of other youth climate strikers who were there, and amazing reps from the Global South, climate justice activists who have been doing this for decades, as well as the incredible youth movement that has grown up over the past year, 2 years, 3 years. I think what we saw more than ever before was just how stark the disconnect is between the movement in the streets and the actual pace of negotiations in the hall and commitments from governments. I think in the past, the climate justice movement has been strong and beautiful, of course, but not at a scale to actually inflict political pain in many places. It's something that the governments have essentially been able to say, oh yes, they're here in the halls at COP, but not have to worry about a lot back at home, for instance. And I think this was the year when we have really started to see that change. Of course, as I mentioned, there's been a powerful movement, an intersectional movement building for decades. But with the advent of the youth strikers, with the advent of things like the Green New Deal in the United States, with increasing climate impacts around the globe, which are increasingly undeniable, I think we've seen significantly more political pressure exerted. Climate is becoming a top tier issue in the US, in the EU, in many places around the world. And meanwhile, the climate talks are essentially stuck in the same rhythm that they have been for 25 years, which is very incremental change, if any change at all in progress, certainly not at the scale that's needed. And so I think this was a year when we saw that more stark than ever, when there was more media coverage of this event, when it was kind of more clear than ever that what's happening is not nearly sufficient. And I think governments are still grappling with how to deal with that, and how to deal with the massive public pressure that they're getting as amazing activists like Greta continue to expose just how woefully insignificant the action has been.
Now, in previous COPs, the UN climate conferences, there have been activists or representatives from civil society, both inside and outside the halls where discussions are happening, where the panels are taking place and the talks are being given. What was the feeling like in Madrid at this latest COP, the COP25? Were there and there have also been instances where people have been, you know, left out or not allowed in, or the requirements for credentials so stringent that it effectively left out a lot of people. So what was the dynamic between the official proceedings and that pressure from the grassroots?
Absolutely. As I mentioned, I think this year, the pressure from what we call civil society, from NGOs, from activists, from youth strikers, from people on the streets, was stronger than ever before in many ways. And it's a testament to the movement that is building and the movement that activists in Madrid and of Spain have built. On the Friday of the first week, so Friday, December 6th, the first week of COP, we saw 500,000 people in the streets of Madrid, over 500,000 people out calling for climate justice with a massive march through the center of town as the talks were kind of at their midpoint. And I think that's one of the absolute largest marches we've ever seen during a COP. I think it's the largest by a significant margin, actually. And that was some of the outside pressure that was happening. You also had groups like Fridays for Future in Madrid, like Extinction Rebellion, like many other activist groups taking action outside the conference center, blockading streets, bringing in props, banners, signs. I think it was very clear that there is a powerful movement on the streets, and in many ways it's increasingly encroaching on this UN space and not letting it be ignored. And then I think you also saw a powerful movement within the talks. And this is where that inside-outside connection is so important, that those of us who are inside the talks are in close collaboration with those who are on the outside and able to bring in as many of those messages as possible. We held a number of actions throughout the 2 weeks to highlight things like the need to stop fossil fuel expansion, the need to stop the Teck tar sands mine in Canada, or exploitation of the Permian Basin in Texas and New Mexico, or the Vaca Muerta shale play in Argentina. We had frontline activists from all those places coming into the talks, raising their voices, speaking up, calling out their governments for not doing enough. And then one thing I want to highlight specifically, during the second week, we had a sort of escalating arc of actions. And on Wednesday of the second week, which was about a week and a half into the climate talks, it was clear that negotiations were moving at a glacial pace, that we were headed for a bad outcome, that we were heading for a failure of COP25. And so we did something that's not been done very many times in the history of the COP, and certainly not for several years. We took united action across all the different constituencies of NGOs and activists who were inside, from the trade unions, to the faith communities, to the women and gender constituency, to the climate justice activists, to the youth, to the more established and even more centrist NGOs. All of these groups came together and said, enough is enough, and held what's called an unauthorized protest inside. Essentially, we didn't clear it with anybody. We didn't talk to the UN about it. People came together, in a pretty spontaneous demonstration directly outside one of the negotiating halls, as there was an important meeting going on, and made themselves heard. And the response was disproportionately violent, disproportionately aggressive by UN security, and then by the Spanish police as well, and contracted security. And they actually forced people outside, surrounded them, kept them detained for several hours in the cold, and then eventually forced them outside, and 300 people lost their badges for the day.
Wow.
As you mentioned, they weren't able to come back that day. They actually barred access to the negotiations for all civil society observers for the rest of the day. We were able to, in the end, particularly because so much of this had been captured by media, because it was going viral online, we were able to negotiate and get nearly everybody back in the next day. So it wasn't a long-term debadging, but I think it is indicative of how, even as climate impacts worsen, even as fossil fuel production expands, even as emissions are rising and the talks are not producing what they need to, the UN and the countries who are leading it are still forcing the people out. Meanwhile, big polluters like Shell, BP, Chevron, the fossil fuel company lobby had more than 100 representatives inside, and they certainly weren't kicked out. So I think it's really indicative of who is in charge at the moment and where their priorities lie. But I do think that we're starting to break through and reach a breaking point where that's going to change.
Well, then finally, let me ask you what role those leading negotiations played, in particular Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General of the United Nations, who has, at least on paper, urged for greater action, has denounced inaction. Also, what role did Carolina Schmidt, the Chilean environment minister who headed the talks, play? Did these two figures play a positive role, or essentially, you know, make it easy for the fossil fuel company representatives in the room to feel comfortable?
Yeah, it's a great question, Sonali. I think, as you mentioned, each of these are individuals. They have their own personal feelings and then, of course, professional obligations and political tensions that they're dealing with. I think, and this is a personal point of view, but I think somewhat shared, is that Secretary General Guterres has played a largely positive role. I think he's been quite forthright in talking about the need to do things like end fossil fuel subsidies around the world and end finance for fossil fuels, to be able to use that money to put it to much better use, to stop expanding the production of fossil fuels, and to generally call for more increased ambition. I thought one of the things that he did this September, which was actually quite unprecedented, he called a UN climate summit in New York, which does have precedent, but he actually excluded Japan, for instance, from speaking at the summit and said, as long as you are continuing to finance coal, you are not welcome on this stage. That's something that he has the power to do at the UN in New York. It wasn't something that he was in control of at this conference, but I think that's the sort of action, which is actually a very significant geopolitical moment, in which there are real consequences for a country's continued funding of fossil fuels, for instance. And I think that's the sort of conversation that we increasingly need to be having around sanctions, around actual penalties for the major polluters and the fossil fuel executives who are in their ears. Minister Schmidt, as you mentioned, Carolina Schmidt from Chile, I think there was largely dissatisfaction with her leadership. I wasn't incredibly involved in that part of the negotiations to know, but I do think that people were quite frustrated, as I mentioned, that the negotiations ran well over long.
She's part of an administration that's fairly right-wing and is under political siege right now with the massive crisis in Chile, which is why the COP meeting actually got moved to Madrid, right?
Correct. Thank you for that context. I think it's very important, yes, to note that this is a country that was so committed to continued repression of its activists in many ways that it refused to hold the talks at home for fear of the world coming and finding out, and said that they wanted it to be held by somewhere else instead. So this is already a country that is repressing its own people, that is killing environmental defenders, that has police on the streets every day. So we were not expecting good things, as I mentioned. One last quick thing I want to highlight as to Chile's behavior as the presidency was a series of meetings convened on Saturday night, in which it was well over the negotiations. They had already gone more than 24 hours late. Some of the biggest topics were on the table, and a group of some of the world's biggest polluters and some of the biggest actors met in secret, essentially, on some of these topics and excluded the small island states, some of the least developing countries, many of the African countries. That's not something that signals that you're actually trying to reach an agreement with everybody. It's something that signals that you're willing to bow to the rich and powerful interests, the fossil fuel interests who are running these talks. So I think there was definitely a divergence in the way that Secretary General Guterres and Minister Schmidt reviewed, for instance.
Colin, give out a website for Oil Change US.
Absolutely. www.oilchangeus.org.
I want to thank you so much for joining us today. You must be exhausted. Good luck traveling back to the US, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on, Sonali. Happy to be here.
My guest has been Colin Rees, senior campaigner with Oil Change US, joining us from Madrid, Spain, where the COP25 meeting has wrapped up. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.